This is the Education Gadfly Show.
You know, you say it's a tricky issue. I say some of those people down there are being a bunch of idiots. All right, mind your own business.
It's tricky, Mike. It's tricky.
Mind your own business.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Lady Mary of Education Policy, Victoria Sears.
Thanks, Mike. Very happy to be joining this week.
Well, Victoria, I had to throw that in because, you know, you and I are both big fans of Downton Abbey.
Although you call this season boring, I have to say I'm getting nervous. We only have two episodes left, so I'm already in withdrawals.
All right. I have to say, you know, I watched the first couple episodes and I've kind of fallen off. I'm going to get back to them, I promise. But let's face it, the big thing on everyone's mind this week, it's not Valentine's Day, though nice red. You're wearing the red.
Thank
that's
you.
Nice. It's House of Cards. That's right. Every single episode, season two. Are you a House of Cards fan?
Not yet. I need to catch up on season one. So right. I've been slipping in that area.
So what is it? You have a British background, of course. Your parents are both British.
Both British.
Both British.
I'm
so,
a dual citizen.
Dual citizen. So this helps to explain the Downton Abbey
allegiances,
thing.
Yep.
But what else do you like about this? I mean, some people say, why do people love seeing such a classist society portrayed? This
but Mike,
upstairs,
they're shaking
downstairs.
Things up. That's the whole, you know, the season is about things are changing.
Things are changing.
Things are changing. Yeah. And it's going to be very exciting to see what happens with the Abbey.
Okay, I love it. With the Abbey. I love it. Okay, hey, but we got to figure out what's going on with the education reform. So let's do it. Pamela, let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
The New York Board of Regents recommended 19 changes to the rollout of the Common Core in the Empire State. Originally, those included allowing teachers to contest their evaluation ratings if their districts have done a poor job implementing the Common Core. But in the face of pressure from unions and the governor, they nixed it. Was that a good move?
Wait, which move? I've got whiplash here, Victoria. Let's get this straight. Okay, so the regents, well, amid all this backlash in New York, that's really been about the teacher evaluations, though people talk about it being about Common Core, say, okay, we're going to have a bunch of things to try to slow down the stakes attached to Common Core, attached to the teacher evaluations. But Governor Cuomo was not happy with that. So then they backed off. They're backing off.
Right. It really seems like a case of strange bedfellows here. You have the teachers unions who are against this because it's, you know, not going far enough. And you have Cuomo here who's saying it's too lenient. So it's really an interesting thing to look at.
You know, so Cuomo, it looks like he spent a lot of political capital getting these teacher evaluations that include a look at test scores. You know, there was a big brouhaha in the city, and this is related to the Race to the Top grant. So I guess maybe he's feeling burned that he's spent all this capital and now the regents are just going to say, hey, if you don't like your evaluation and your school district has kind of sucked at Common Core implementation,
blame
you're
it
off
on
the
implementation.
Hook.
Yep.
Yeah. But Victoria, tell us, you did some blog posts on this topic earlier this year. I mean, how are other states handling this issue about this collision course between Common Core and the teacher evaluations?
Right. I mean, I think this is going to be huge in the coming, you know, months and years. New York is such an interesting case in it. And, you know, there's a lot of politics going on that everybody's seeing with this clash between teacher evaluation in Common Core. New York is unique because they've sort of created their own Common Core curriculum and sort of building this set of curriculum that other states don't have. At the same time, they've been unique in sort of creating their own Common Core aligned assessments, where we've seen in a lot of other states that we've looked at, they've really kind of sort of tweaked old tests and made them to be a bit more Common Core aligned, but New York sort of scrapped everything and came out with this new assessment last year. So they've kind of been dealing with it a little bit earlier than other states, and it's a very interesting study there.
Hey, and you know, we by all accounts, we think we like the curriculum they've developed. I mean, we still got to plunge in and look more at it. It is a voluntary curriculum. But this thing about rushing ahead with the tests, about continuing to tie stakes to the teacher evaluations, you got to say, what are they thinking? Come on, New York, get your act together. This is not, look, in my view, Victoria, look, this is common sense. We are asking teachers to do something hard, which is to change the way they teach and to reach for these much higher standards. And so we do not want teachers feeling like their heads are on the chopping block when they are trying to do something like that. Give it a couple of years. And hey, anyways, it's New York. We're never going to be able to fire a teacher in New York. Give it up.
Exactly. And, you know, I think what we found when we did a little bit of research last summer and fall in New York is that the city's sort of already adopting some unofficial policies where they're giving teachers this sort of hold harmless, where, you know, they're not going to attach any high stakes decisions to these assessments in the first coming years. And that's really in fairness while we settle sort of all the ups and downs of Common Core.
So. All right. Topic number two.
There was a flap this week in New Orleans when a teacher took to the Atlantic to criticize another local school for its rigid discipline policies. Is that fair game, or should we tolerate different approaches in this realm?
So, you know, here it comes, Victoria. There's been a lot of talk about discipline lately, about suspensions and whether we should ban school suspensions at all costs. I'll be honest. I really think this is an area where we need to allow schools to do what works and to be different from one another, right? And if a certain discipline policy helps to create a positive learning environment, especially if we're not talking about pushing kids out of the school, but using these different tools to make the school better, come on, people, stop the judgment, stop the hating.
Exactly. You know, I think we have the federal government coming out and really urging everybody to back away from suspensions. And it almost seems like it's putting schools in a difficult place where educators are really worried about, you know, going too far and getting some backlash from the community. So I think, you know, we really do need to, you don't want to be kicking kids out of school left and right, but you really do have to worry about the kids that are left in the classroom and keeping it productive and keeping it safe. So I agree with you that, you know, kind of based on the population in the schools and really leaving it up to states and educators in the local areas.
And you know, Nirav Kingsland wrote a great piece for us and for Education Next this week, where he kind of goes after this issue and says, look, it is, you know, if we believe in school choice, we've got to let schools be different from one another. Now, those of us at Fordham have been arguing strongly that we need to hold all schools of choice accountable for results in terms of student achievement, right? And people say, and this is understandable, that that's going to force these schools to become more similar from one another, that they're going to have to at least teach to this test, or they're going to have to pay attention to the standards that the tests are understood. But we also need to make sure we keep making this argument that says, look, we do not want to regulate everything else, right? So what, we're going to force them to use the exact same discipline procedures? We're going to force them to use what, the exact same attendance policies, the exact same, dress code? I mean, do we believe in letting schools be different from one another or not? And this, to me, is a clear place where we have got to allow schools to be different, and especially schools like the one that's an issue in New Orleans, the Psy Academy, that's getting amazing results for very needy kids.
Right. I think it's a really tricky issue, but if you're giving people flexibility and the students are learning and student achievement is good, then that's a positive indicator.
I love it. So positive, you know, and nice too, Victoria. I tell you, you're nice. You say it's a tricky issue. I say some of those people down there are being a bunch of idiots. All right. Mind your own business.
It's tricky, Mike. It's tricky.
Mind your own business. All right. Go ahead. Topic number three.
Advanced placement classes continue to grow in popularity, largely due to efforts to make them widely available to low-income and minority students. Is this democratization of AP a good direction?
What do you think, Victoria? Many reformers have supported this for years. A lot of funders behind this. This is a good thing, right? More kids taking AP classes.
Right. In theory, it's a wonderful idea, and you want to get as many kids as possible into these classes that are going to be exposing them to college-level coursework. But I think, again, you know, as with the discipline issues we were just talking about, you really have to look at outcomes. Are the kids who are taking the new additional kids that are taking these AP classes passing the exams? Mm-hmm. Are they graduating from college college and high school at higher rates? So I think there's a whole host of things, and the jury's kind of still out on those.
I mean, look, I think if you're talking about high schools that right now don't have any AP classes, then adding AP classes is almost surely a good thing, because in almost every high school, you're going to have some kids who are going to be ready for those courses, right?
And we're not there yet, right?
And we're not. No, there's still some like 40% of all high schools. Now, we got to make sure that those kids are getting a challenging curriculum from the beginning so they're ready for that stuff. The tougher question are high schools. Let's say your typical suburban high school that's been doing AP forever, and now there's a big push to democratize those classes, to basically lessen the gates to those classes, to basically make it, you know, safe. And anybody who wants to take an AP class can take an AP class, right? And the thinking is, from Jay Matthews and others who have argued, hey, the kids who take these classes, even if they don't pass the test, they are more likely to go to college. It gives them an understanding of what that looks like. Here's the problem, Victoria. What about the kids who really are ready for AP, right? The highest achieving kids who, let's say, a few years ago would have an AP class with only other high achieving kids. And that was good for them, right? Now they've got an AP class that might be going slower, or where the teachers now has to figure out, how do I teach this more heterogeneous group of kids? I mean, why don't we ever think about the high achieving kids? It seems like their needs just get thrown under the bus.
That's a good point. And I think that's something that, you know, educators and teachers of AP classes should really be cognizant of as they're trying to democratize this. But I think we're getting a bit ahead of ourselves here, and we really need to focus on getting kids to grade level before automatically trying to dump everybody into these AP classes that they may or may not be ready for.
So. You know, it's all about unintentional consequences, you know, just like this morning, right? I'm sure the guy plowing my street didn't mean to, you know, intentionally plow 4 feet of hard, icy snow in front of my driveway, though he did. Thanks a lot, man.
It's true. And, you know, I have to go on the record and say I'm a big fan of AP classes because I only had to take one semester of college language class. And I just chatting in the Spanish classes, watching soap operas and having conversations about it. But, you know, it's, you know.
Saved you some coin. You gotta love that. All right. That is all the time we've got for Pardon the Gadfly. Now it is time for everybody's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Kara, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So we just introduced this as Amber's Research Minute, but no, Amber, thanks to the snow this week and a vacation that Amber's got, right?
Yeah, she's someplace warm. We are not.
She is lucky. Okay, we got to ask you, Victoria here with us today, she's a huge Downton Abbey fan, as am I. What's your take? Have you seen The Abbey?
No. I don't do period dramas, period.
This cuts me to the core, Derek.
I know. It's me. I just can't get into it.
As a general rule?
Yeah.
You've never seen a Jane Austen movie?
Maybe it was a backlash to all the Jane Austen and Bronte that I had to read in high school, but it was never my thing.
You're a Jane Austen fan too,
absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Of course. Yep. Yeah. All right. Well, I am curious about how people see the politics of Downton Abbey. You know, is this conservative? Is it liberal? Is it what is this? Or is it just a guilty pleasure?
I think all of the above, Mike. I mean, you kind of have sort of the old traditional way of doing things, but then it's shaking up and you really are invested in these people who live downstairs.
Next week, we're talking about House of Cards.
What I do like is that, you know, the Fordham Institute here, we right now are all working on one floor, but starting next year, we're going to have some people on the seventh floor and some people on the eighth floor. So we'll start to refer to those people on the seventh floor as the people who live downstairs. Right? This is good.
As an eighth floor person, I'm all about it.
Yes. Okay, good. All right, Dara, with that great introduction, tell us what you got for us this week.
Today, it is a Mathematica study on the effect of charter high schools on long-term educational attainment and earnings. It is a much-needed addition to the literature. Normally, this stuff looks at high school outcomes, test scores, whether students graduate, things like that. Those outcomes are interesting, but what we really want to see is the impact of education on things like college enrollment, employment, future income. So this study does just that. It uses longitudinal data to determine whether enrollment in a charter high school is related to high school graduation, college entrance and persistence, and students' earnings in adulthood. The authors used longitudinal data from Florida and Chicago 10 years, 1998 to 2009, which met the two needs of the study, that K-12 data is linked to post-secondary data, and that the data is collected long enough to follow students through and after high school. Unfortunately, both of those criteria are fairly rare. Mm-hmm. In total, they examined about 5,200 students, comparing eighth grade charter students who went on to attend a charter high school with eighth grade charter students who did not go on to attend a charter high school. Hmm. That's how they dealt with the selection bias, because you do have a certain type of student who is more likely to enroll in a charter school.
Right. And this is not a random assignment. And study. So this is the way to handle some of that.
It is one way to handle some of that.
Right.
It's not ideal, but it is better than just looking at eighth graders or high school enrollment period.
Yeah.
The study found statistically significant results across all of the outcomes. Students who continued to a charter high school were 7 to 11% more likely to graduate and about 10% more likely to attend college. In Florida, those students were also about 13% more likely to persist in college at least 2 years. And also in Florida, students who attended a charter high school had an annual increase in earnings of about $2,400 per year, up to 12 years after they started high school. Of course, the caveat is that you can't actually tell what caused the improved educational attainment and labor outcomes, and the findings aren't generalizable to other locations. But even so, it is a good start.
Very interesting. And in line with what we've seen now, study, Roland Fryer study and the Harlem Children's Zone Charter School. I mean, more and more people are trying to look at these long-term outcomes, which I'm a huge fan of because, as you said, Dara, these are the things that we really fundamentally care about, right? Test scores we use as proxies and kind of short-term indicators. But it does seem like some of the evidence is showing that some of these charter schools, and I would say also some of the private school choice programs, Catholic schools, seem to have a bigger impact on these real-world outcomes than they do on test scores.
Right. And of course, though, you have this critical problem of, do these schools have an impact on outcomes that we care about, whatever those are, or are these students who attend these type of schools more likely to do better anyway? But this study is a really good model for how to control for that. Mm-hmm. And I know that people are hesitant to do these types of studies, number one, because of data availability, but number two, because there is... the claim of bias is right there.
Yep.
And so, you know, I think it's a huge reason to not shy away from these studies and, you know, showing that it can be done just carefully.
And Victoria, what's your, I mean, if you had to guess what it might be that's making these schools, if they really are getting better results, let's say that they deal with the selection bias. Okay. Right. I mean, what is it, all this sort of non-cognitive skills stuff? What is it?
It's a good question. I'd be interested in Dara's take. You know, I really... I think it might be a whole blend of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a bunch of different things. I think you might also have in a private school and a charter, perhaps a charter school to a lesser degree, the school itself is less centered around a testing culture. Mm-hmm. And so you're able to better instill non-cognitive skills because your focus is not necessarily on your test scores. Yeah. You go to a charter school or a private school for a reason other than test scores.
Yeah. No. And look, there's peer effects that might be positive, right? Lots of other kids are aiming to go to college, you know, all that kind of stuff. Well, look, this is exciting. And Dara's right. We need lots more of these kinds of studies and not just on choice. I mean, on any kinds of interventions to try to be able to look at the long-term real-world impacts, especially when we talk about high school. And by the way, if we can start to do this better, we can start to get rid of test-based accountability, at least for high schools, maybe, and focus instead on these real-world outcomes so that even traditional public schools can focus on the bigger picture.
Sounds good.
All right.
Who doesn't want that?
We love it. Upstairs and downstairs are both in favor of that. Okay, that's all the time we've got for this week's edition of the Education Gadfly Slow / Downton Abbey. We'll have to talk about House of Cards next week, Dara. We'll get to that once we've all binge watched it a little bit over the weekend. Until then,
I'm Lady Victoria Sears.
Lovely. And I am Sir Michael Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.